Every summer, wherever you are in the world, Cape Crusaders save us from global catastrophe and deranged megalomaniacs, and we pay millions of euros, dollars and pounds globally to watch the spectacle. And on the whole, the good guys win and the bad guys lose, and yet even so, their job is never done, and next year we're going to come back for more. And cynics have a very simple explanation for this. Hollywood invests millions in making these movies. They cost stupid amounts of money to make. And so to guarantee profits, they must invest similar amounts in marketing and all the rest. And so that's why they're so successful. Well, there's some truth in that. But the question is, which came first, the superhero or the salesman? Now, that might seem rather a sort of silly, facetious question. After all, aren't superheroes just sort of harmless fun for kids? These blockbusters, they're not serious movies. They're not sort of significant works of art, so we're told. And in fact, renowned director of The Godfather and all that lot, Francis Ford Coppola, was asked what he thought of Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. And this is what Coppola said. There he is. I did see it, The Dark Knight, and Christopher Nolan is certainly a fabulous filmmaker, such a talented person, but you know, it's still a guy dressed up in a silly costume. Harsh, but fair. Well, is that all that's going on? What does their popularity, and this is the thing that intrigues me, what is it about these superhero movies that makes them so popular, and what does that reveal about our culture? I think, you know, the money men must return to these subjects for a reason. Why is it that they are almost guaranteed to sell well? Because in the end, that's all they're concerned about. And I think it's because they have a guaranteed appeal, because they tap into something much bigger, much deeper, much grander. You see, there's a direct link from Superman and Batman all the way back to the mythic heroes like Achilles, Hercules and Gilgamesh. And of course, everybody loves a good story. We all love stories. And that's partly because they're escapists. You know, they help us to sort of get out of the mundane and the boring and the day-to-day. But they also help us to understand our own lives better. We love stories because somebody else's, even fictitious, experience can sometimes inform our own, can't it? So that's one reason we like them. But I think there's even more to it than that. You see, I think we get swept up in these stories because they resonate with something of our deepest yearnings. Now, of course, C.S. Lewis is a figure who crops up at the ELF a lot, and he is a remarkable person. And he's famous mainly, I guess, for most people because of the Narnia books and therefore the Narnia films. But he was far more than a writer of family-friendly fiction, of course. He was a top-class academic at both Oxford and Cambridge, and he wrote many books to help people understand what he called mere Christianity. In other words, the heart of Christianity. And think about it like this. He says in the book called Mere Christianity, he asks the question, why do we get hungry? And this is how he answers it. We'll come to that quote as part of this bigger one. Let me start from where it begins. Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there is such a thing as sex. So, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that it was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy that desire, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. Well, that is what lies behind what I want to talk about now. Could it be that the sort of fantastical stories of Cape Crusaders suggest a reality beyond? Well, I want to start by thinking about the arrival of the superhero and ask where he came from. Does anyone know who that chap is? Friedrich Nietzsche. He famously declared that God was dead and that without God, morality is destroyed. In its place, the only way to avoid nihilism was to strive after power. He coined the word in German, Übermensch. Literally, it means overman or superman. And he saw something magnetically attractive about such a figure, something truly heroic, someone who overcomes and strives and succeeds to gain power. And the 20th century perfectly illustrated, of course, doesn't it? Perfectly illustrate what happens when people take that sort of thing very seriously. So Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and a countless range of others. Each puts people off the idea of the strong arm of the Superman because that's what they strove to be. But of course, that has the benefit of hindsight. We can look back on that and see that that's what they were doing. But it's not hard to see why this idea of the Übermensch was something that attracted Hitler. So it comes as a rather a surprise that actually the very same notion influenced the creation of one of the most famous superheroes, Superman. Jerry Siegel first created the comic character Superman and produced the first ever cartoon. Here's a copy of the very first comic of Superman in January 1933. And he deliberately modeled this character on Nietzsche's ideal. That's a bit of a surprise. And the interesting thing is that Superman started out not as a hero, but as a villain. And if you see, basically, the title of this first comic was The Reign of the Superman. It was a short story, not quite in sort of comic book form as it would later become. It was a short story aimed to help raise a bit of cash during the Great Depression. And it was illustrated by a friend of his called Joe Shuster. And the two would form a famous partnership over the next few years. And over time, Shuster redesigned the character and Superman evolved into the sort of character we know more today, the sort of less dubious character and the more wholesome model of behavior. The interesting thing is, though, of course, that Übermensch didn't completely disappear from the books, and he lived on, in fact, in a new guise, in Superman's arch-enemy, Lex Luthor. And what is fascinating, if you look at a picture of Kevin Spacey playing Lex Luthor in Bryan Singer's recent remake, you might notice a similarity between him and the way Superman was originally conceived. And that change in the character of Superman from ultimate baddie trying to overtake the world to super goodie trying to save the world is itself revealing. Because you see, what was going on at this time? Well, the comic strip was a peculiarly 20th century phenomenon, and particularly an American phenomenon, although, you know, for instance, Japanese culture took it on very much so, and there are other parts as well. But and also the whole sort of culture of big blockbuster movies was a peculiar 20th century American phenomenon as well. And actually, the success of these two things is not surprising, bearing in mind the success of America and its influence on the rest of the world. So you can see that these things go hand in hand. I guess if, you know, the comic book character of Superman had just come from a much smaller country on one side of the world without the sort of resources and Hollywood and everything else, it wouldn't have taken off. So partly the global popularity is the result of where America found itself during the 20th century. But what is very interesting is I think if you dig around some of the historical context behind these characters, and Superman by no means was the only one, you find some very interesting things. So one of the things you find is what you might call the depersonalization of the American city. Basically, urbanization happened very rapidly, not just in the States, of course, but also across Europe and parts of the rest of the world. And a good illustration of this is, I find, the paintings of Edward Hopper. I don't know whether you know any of his, but one of his most famous is called Night Hawks, which is a sort of a prohibition era image, you know, when alcohol was banned and you couldn't buy it. So you have this sort of milk bar at night, and you just have a few very lonely characters sitting at the bar. It's probably sort of 3 a.m, and it's very lonely. But here are one or two other ones that are less well known, but they're all illustrating something very similar. Basically, what you have is just the sheer loneliness of the new urban landscape. Just the isolation. And very often you find, if there is more than one person in Hopper's pictures, you find no one's talking to anybody else. They're all in their own little bubble. And you can see that here's a picture of a train carriage, all facing in different directions from each other. They're not talking. They're completely in their own little worlds. This one you can't quite see. This is of the docks in New York. And just on the bottom left, there's just one solitary figure, probably sort of trudging home after a hard day's work at the docks. Again, completely alone. Now, of course, if you know anything about American cities, they're not, you know, you can't really be alone. There's, and London's like that, and many big international cities are like that. You've got people everywhere, and yet you've got people who are incredibly alone. And that sort of culture of painting, you find, really does give that sense. And cities in 30s America during the Great Depression could be very dangerous places. The prevailing urban scenery was one of sort of hostility and fear. There's a yearning for something better. And that was what the American dream was supposed to be about. And yet, the reality, especially in the Great Depression, was far removed from what everyone was attracted to in the first place. So reality was far removed from the dream. And so there's a sense in which there's no wonder that people were attracted to superheroes who could at least offer a dream of rescue, however fantastical and unreal. You know, if you're looking for something, if your life is hard and tough, it's always very interesting to see what means by which you find escapism. But it wasn't just that cities were scary. Actually, just think of the world stage at the time. There were threats from overwhelming forces in all kinds of places. We forget that the 20th century, in many ways, was a terrifying time to be alive, a time of encircling armies and empires, threatening forces that seemed to be on the verge of global domination. I mean, we look back now on, you know, the fall of communism and the sort of mixed blessing that has been. I mean, we should certainly not be triumphalistic about 1989, but it's fascinating that before that, for many people in the West particularly, the idea that communism was going to end just seemed inconceivable. And for the average person on the street, what was going on around the world was just too big, too overwhelming to even have anything to do to put a stop to it. So from the 1930s to 80s, you had the twin threats of fascism and communism. And there was very little to choose in terms... There seemed very little ground in between the two. And you know, different countries in Europe slid from one extreme to the other with great rapidity, particularly those in Central Europe who were perhaps trying to find hope for a middle way, but found themselves being pulled one way or the other. And of course, this fueled the paranoia of the McCarthy era in the 50s, with the possibility of communists taking over America. And it was a paranoia that was driven by an almost sort of pathological fear, got completely out of proportion, and absolutely, ironically, became just as sort of surveillance minded and keeping an eye on people as the Eastern Bloc were. So during the McCarthy era, in some ways, there wasn't that much to choose from the culture of suspicion on either side of the Berlin Wall. But then, of course, after that, you see the fall of communism and the sort of post-1989 world didn't necessarily mean that everything was going to be okay now, because, of course, what are we dealing with now? Well, terrorism and environmental catastrophe. The big questions for the next generation to try and sort out. And the environmental catastrophe that is happening all around us is really going to be a problem for our children. You know, whether or not it's climate change, I'm not going to get into all of that, and you know, climate change deniers and all that sort of stuff. There is no question that what we are doing to our planet is going to have terrible consequences. You just have to look at parts of the world where sort of rapid industrialization was left abandoned and just left to rot, and the most terrible consequences are being seen. And then, of course, whichever generation, whichever century, in fact, whichever era or place you're living in, there's the sort of curse of organized crime. I mean, are you feeling depressed yet? I mean, basically, we've got some serious issues here. And, you know, it's the triads in Hong Kong, or the mafia in Italy and Albania and Russia, the drug smuggling cartels of Colombia. You name it, they're everywhere, and they seem, you know, you kill one and ten appear. These are the sorts of things that superheroes can sort out. So that is precisely what motivates Bruce Wayne in Batman Begins, which is a sort of reboot of the franchise after some pretty dire examples of it. A reboot by Christopher Nolan. And here you have Christian Bale as Bruce Wayne coming home from Asia. His trusty butler, Alfred, played by Michael Caine, comes and picks him up, and they have a conversation about why he's coming back to Gotham.
Master Wayne, you've been gone a long time.
Yes, I have.
You look very fashionable. Apart from the man. Are you coming back to Gotham for long, sir?
As long as it takes. I want to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city.
Yeah.
Anyway, their murder shot the wealthy and the powerful into action.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible, I can be everlasting.
I don't know whether you sort of managed to pick up some of that, but basically there's a sense of powerlessness with the corruption and violence and fear within Gotham City. His parents got killed in a mugging, senseless mugging in front of his eyes when he was a child. But they had sort of naive aspirations to be able to change and lift people out of poverty and everything else, but failed. And he wants to be something more, something other, to be able to do something about it. At that stage, he's just talking about being a symbol and a model to sort of galvanize people into being different. But of course, as the films develop, as it's been sort of rebooted in this form, you find that actually he's having to be much more proactive. He can't just be a model. And of course, when you get to the end of The Dark Knight, things have gone horribly wrong. Dark Knight is an incredibly complex film and absolutely astonishing film. But what I think is also going on here is there's a sense in which there's a search for a vocabulary of evil. When terror struck at the heart of the real Gotham City on 9/11, the shock was felt across the world. I was living in Kampala in Uganda at the time, and it just shows how global and small our world has become. I just happened to be at home that day, and someone just rang me up and said, "Mark, you've got to turn on your TV," and I saw the second plane fly in live on the other side of the world. And then what was extraordinary was within hours, there was a massive security clampdown within Kampala. And you think, what's going on? And I remember I was just going to go into one of the hotels to get a film developed in the old days when you got films developed. Suddenly I had to go through all kinds of metal detectors just to go to the camera shop. It has had a global impact. One of the reasons is because of the embassy bombings, the American embassy in East Africa a few years before, and there seemed at the time, you know, everyone was considering everything. They thought there might be some links with East Africa. But what was interesting is the dust settled on Ground Zero, and then a few years later, as we had almost the same sort of thing, on not quite the same scale, but the same sort of thing in London, 7/7, people suddenly were trying to work out what to call this. In a previous generation, it would have been easy to describe. But in the articles, in the commentary, in the endless sort of punditry and soul-searching that happened after these events, there was an incredible reluctance to use words like evil or wrong. You could use extremities of words like horror and appalling atrocity and all these sort of things. They were sort of, in a sense, neutral, morally neutral, well, they're not morally neutral. They were sort of descriptive in a sense that is not quite going as far as words like evil. Because, of course, as soon as you start talking about evil, you need a benchmark by which to measure it. How do you decide what is evil? How do you decide what's evil as opposed to somebody else's culture? What if it is somebody else's culture to make it acceptable to fly a plane into a building? How does a relativist cope with that? If it's culturally acceptable, if that's just the way they do it in their culture, who are we to say you can't do it? And as soon as you start talking about things like evil, you suddenly have the problem that you might be held to account. It's a bit of a problem. And so many of the secular pundits were twisting themselves into total knots trying to describe what was going on. Now, of course, many Christians and other people of religious faith and background, a religious worldview, didn't have a problem with it. But it was very interesting in the secular West to see what difficulty it brought. But somehow in the superhero stories, and I think this is the point, right and wrong, good and evil, that's the daily diet, isn't it? That's what it's all about. So I'm going to show you a chilling scene. This is pretty horrible. It's probably just as well the curtain's open. It's in Spider-Man where the Green Goblin, who's the baddie, storms in. Peter Parker's widowed aunt is at her bedside prayers. She's praying the Lord's Prayer. Just look for the timing of this dramatic entry.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us.
I mean, that's not an accident, is it? They know what they're doing. And she's just about to say, deliver us from evil, and then in pops evil incarnate. And what's even more chilling is that the Green Goblin knows exactly what's going on and forces her to finish the sentence and laughs. You can do that in a superhero film, couldn't you? You can't do that in a sort of realistic so-called film, a sort of kitchen sink film. Somehow we can cope with our evil on the screen, perhaps because we know it's just fiction. We can cope with it as long as it stays there. We all love our fictional villains and baddies, don't we? And actors love playing the baddies. They hate playing the goodies. Actors, you know, they've got something to get their teeth into with baddies. The heroes are usually far too boring. So I just wonder, could it be that our ongoing love affair with superheroes in part owes much to a deep-seated desire for evil to be judged rather than relativized? Could that be something to do with it? I just wonder. Now, superhero evil comes in many forms. It might be the sort of irrational and unpredictable nature of evil, as in the Joker in The Dark Knight, or the sheer criminality of Gotham's organized crime. But often it could be sort of total megalomania, like General Zod or Lex Luthor in Superman. And in them, you see Nietzsche's quest for power at its most explicit. So here's a great bit. This is Kevin Spacey being just brilliant as Lex Luthor. I think he's better than Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor. Get a load of this. Hopefully. Come on, sort it out. I love that gods are selfish beings who fly around in little red capes, and it's about power. And basically he's on the hunt for Superman's secret lair in the Arctic, where he can nick his source of his secret and power and everything else, and get some kryptonite. Now, there's a whole range, there's a whole sort of diverse expression of these sort of evil things, but in a sense, I suppose I want to say welcome to our generation, because you see, God may be dead, but evil is very much alive, whether we call it that or not. And how we wish it wasn't so. This is Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, who once wrote this: that God does not exist, I cannot deny. That my whole being cries out for God, I cannot forget. Well, if you can't have God, perhaps you can have a superhero. Are they not surrogate gods who are perhaps the shadow of the real thing? Well, here's Superman and Lois in a very touching moment.
Now, you really shouldn't smoke, Miss Lane. Sorry, I didn't mean to start.
No, I'm fine, really. Just wasn't expecting you.
Fellow press on the plane, and I wasn't sure it was the best time for us to talk.
Well, there's no press around now. Except for me, of course.
I know some people ask a lot of questions now that I'm back. I think it's only fair that I answer those people.
So, you're here for an interview? Okay, then.
The right pocket.
Let's start with the big question. Where'd you go?
To Krypton.
But you told me it was destroyed ages ago.
It was. But when Astronomers thought they found it, I had to see for myself.
Well, you're back, and everyone seems to be pretty happy about it.
Not everyone. I read the article.
Yes, I read a lot of people. We're not getting the skills.
That's too bad.
I moved on. So did the rest of us. That's why I wrote it. The world doesn't need a savior. And neither do I.
Isn't that sweet? You wrote that the world doesn't need a savior, but every day I hear people crying out for one. Well, where has all this come from? Well, I suppose if you were wanting to create a new superhero, then there are a number of questions that you need to answer as you're creating your new hero. The first and most important question is to ask where they got their powers from and what makes them stand out from the rest of us. Well, I think when we start asking that question, we find and look at the sort of really popular ones. I know there are hundreds and different types, but let's just take the really popular ones. I think if you ask that question where they get their powers from, you've come up with a simple split into two main groups. And I'm going to call them those superheroes from below and superheroes from above. And you'll see why in a moment. Now, you take superheroes from below, and I think there are, in fact, two subgroups. There's the superheroes from below who are heroes by chance. So Spider-Man is a superhero from below. He's just one of us. And it just so happens that he gets bitten by a radioactive spider. Of course, it could happen to anybody, couldn't it? It just so happened to him. And he's a sort of orphaned, bookish teenager who's bullied by all the other kids. And he's the sort of put-upon everyman. And it is a chance act that changes him. And when living with his uncle, his uncle is killed, he takes on the role of a vigilante. He's going to sort this out. And his uncle has taught him a very important lesson that sticks with him all the way through. With great power comes great responsibility. It's a sort of mantra that gets repeated all the way through. That's his justification for doing what he does, taking things into his own hands and doing the right thing. Or there are those who perhaps are just born like it by genetic mutation. I don't know whether you follow the TV series of Heroes and the films of the X-Men and so on. These guys, they're just born like it. It's just a matter of chance. There's a sort of mutation. They didn't ask for it, but these things mark out these individuals for whatever reason. They have the power to do great good, so the Petrelli brothers in Heroes and Siler, their great enemy, who uses it for great evil. And of course, at the comic end of the spectrum are the Incredibles, who are my favourite superheroes, and I think it should be used in all marriage and parenting counselling, because they are just like everybody else in terms of... Well, you watch the dining room scene and you'll come see it just like our house, without the stretchy arms, of course. They are all superheroes who are people like you and me who, just by some weird quirk of fate or whatever it is, end up being different. But there's another group who are superheroes by choice. There's Batman. There's actually nothing different about him, sort of biologically. He's the sort of millionaire vigilante. He's also orphaned young. When his millionaire parents are killed by a mugger, so he vows to fight organized crime in Gotham, the classic archetypal US city turns nightmare. Could be, you know, it's sort of New York, Chicago, that sort of thing. And he has sort of Bill Gates-sized wealth. He's able to take them on. His only natural gifting is courage and sort of obsessiveness. But because of his business and determination and skill, he accumulates the coolest armory of gadgets you could possibly imagine. I mean, it's an armory to die for, and it makes you want to be filthy rich. Now, most individuals, of course, don't have that sort of wealth, and so, you know, that's completely beyond. But, of course, the state does. So there are a number of superhero types who are funded by the state, and especially the American state. You know, you compare the defense budget of America, and it is more than the next 10 countries put together. So they got the money to be able to do this stuff, and there's a strand of superheroes made by government medicine. So take, it's a bit outdated now, but I remember as a kid, Saturday afternoons, about 5:45, it was the Bionic Man. Get a load of this.
Thank you. anybody to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Cool. Now, who here did not pretend to run really slowly like this and go, okay, right, anyway. Now, that's the classic example. RoboCop is another one. You know, the state can create this super being as a result of technology. Now, there's a very sort of quick survey through all these guys. If we're right about suggesting that superheroes reveal something of our deepest yearnings, what does this suggest is going on? What do the superheroes from below say about what we're looking for? Well, I think there's one simple strand you can say, that if human beings do suffer, then you need somebody else who can understand what you've been through. It takes one human being to understand the sufferings of another. So Spider-Man or Batman suffer as victims of unpunished crime, and that drives them to do something about it. They can easily, therefore, identify with all those who suffer unjustly. Now, I think very often in the West, we've just come to presume on justice. But there are many parts in some parts of Eastern Europe, and certainly in parts of Africa where I lived, where actually there is no hope of human justice at all. In fact, you know, you could almost say that sometimes justice is a luxury of developed nations. And in that sort of situation, you clutch at straws, don't you? And there's a sense in which these guys, you know, it's fantasy, it's not real, we know in the cinema it's not true, and yet there's something that resonates with us because we long for there to be some sort of resolution, some sort of hope. That's what makes them attractive. We can't do anything about it ourselves, but just to go to sit in a cinema for an hour and a half can actually just lift us out of the moment. But there's a darker side to this, because is there not some underlying assumption that actually we can solve the world's problems ourselves if we just apply ourselves? Isn't that the hubris of the Enlightenment, that simply sees progress as inevitable and we just need to apply ourselves and our technology and our minds and we will be able to solve the problems of the world? It just needs a necessary ambition and wealth and resources and skill. Yes, we can. So much for superheroes from below. What about the superheroes from above? Those, the exact opposite. And of course, the most famous of them all is Superman. And we easily forget that Superman's an alien. Perhaps, you know, that's why he hasn't quite got the hang of how to wear his underwear, I don't know. But apart from his superpowers, he looks just like one of us. He's a human being who's come from another planet. So I suppose you might even call him an incarnational alien. And his alter ego, Clark Kent, I mean, a bumbling fool who's the last person you'd expect to be able to fly, let alone walk across the street safely. But he's not your archetypal alien. He doesn't have three eyes and tentacles. He's just another human, a human being from another planet. At home, he's normal, doesn't stick out of the crowd. Come here, and he's different for some reason. Isn't it interesting? He's another orphan, driven by a sense of injustice. What is it? Why? They're all lacking parents. And it's striking, isn't it weird, that this kryptonite comes to Earth and thinks, I know what I need to do. I need to defend truth, justice, and the American way. It's very interesting. I don't know whether you spotted, just about a month ago, there was an article on the BBC website that said that the writers of the latest Superman comics have decided to make Superman renounce his American citizenship and be a citizen of the world. In a way, you sort of think, about time. What is it about America that particularly has got it, and the rest of the world needs saving. Why come to bring truth and justice? Yes, and the American way? Interesting. But of course, he grew up in the Great Depression, and he became part of the sort of popular mainstream as America faced the threats of communism and fascism on either side, and sort of positioned itself as the bulwark against both in the middle. Now, what does this incarnational alien superhero reveal, if anything? Well, doesn't it suggest that in actual fact, there is a sense in which humanity is truly helpless to deal with the big issues? Even the American way is unsustainable without an alien's help. The forces we face are beyond us, and the only hope for rescue comes from beyond ourselves, and therefore beyond our world. And I think that points to the second issue. There is a deep longing for someone or something beyond us. We come back to the C.S. Lewis idea. We hunger for something or someone beyond us because there is someone or something beyond us. Why else do we have this hunger? Or to take Ecclesiastes, as we were thinking about yesterday and this morning, he has put eternity into our hearts, even though we live just for 70 years. And it's a cliche, of course, isn't it? But fact is usually stranger than fiction, with one simple advantage. It's true. And if something works in fiction, it usually works because it touches on something that is true in real life. So what I want to do is to close with what I called echoes of the true superhero, and then there'll be time for some questions. Oh, whoops, there's Superman. Isn't that lovely? Doesn't he look great? Despite the underwear. Right. Echoes of the true superhero. Now, I think there are three echoes in particular that I want to draw out. The first is what I call the echo of humanity. Too many people fail to do justice to humanity's schizophrenic nature. And I include Christians here. History, again and again, pulls us up short, doesn't it? At one side, we are capable of incredibly great good. It's a fact. And the Bible says that this is because we're made in God's image. And Israel's great king David found himself wondering aloud how extraordinary this was. So he sings in Psalm 8, when I consider your heavens, when I sort of, you know, of an evening, I don't know, one of the problems with living in central London, you look up in the sky at night and it's all orange and that's hopeless. So when you're out in the countryside, look up. And you can see the stars. One of the things I loved about living in Uganda, we were in Kampala, but you could look up and the stars were almost, you could almost reach out and grab them. It was just stunning. You look up that and you suddenly think, whoa, where do I fit in this universe? Well, the psalmist asked that precise question centuries ago. He says, when I consider your heavens, I ask, what is man that you're mindful of him? In other words, what on earth? We're just a tiny cosmic speck. Why are you interested in us? Well, it's because he's a creator God who made us in his own image. He made us a little lower than the angels. And being made in God's image is another way of describing being made a little lower than the angels. We're made, whatever being in God's image means, we're made with the greatest potential for the greatest good. Whatever that good might be, whether it's beauty or kindness or justice or love, we have this capacity for all these things. And let's face it, there are people all around the world who are committed to them, whether they're Christian or not. There are some amazing people who do amazing things. And some of the people I admire more than any in this world are actually not Christians at all. And superheroes who stand up for truth and justice and use whatever resources, gifts and talents to that end, they show us what we can be at our best. And yet it all too easily goes sour. Capable, yes, of great good, but also of great evil. It's interesting. The New Testament refers to Psalm 8 in the letter to the Hebrews. And it comments rather dryly when it quotes, "What is man that you're mindful of him, and we be made a little lower than the angels." It comments rather dryly that we do not presently see everything subject to him. It's not quite as it should be. It's very interesting that humanity is not what it should be for a very simple reason, and that's what the Bible calls sin. Sin is not so much doing individual things wrong. Sin is a life lived without gratitude or dependence upon the God who made us. One definition of sin that I like using is that sin is living in God's world as if it was my world. Sin is living in God's world as if it was mine. What arrogance. And that's why we make a complete mess of things. The evil and chaos we see in the superheroes who strive for power are merely a magnification of what we all find in all of us. Both good and evil are tragically present in you and me. And this was something of what Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, the great Scottish writer, was trying to get at when he wrote his horror story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And he said this about it. He said, "I have called my character Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I could just as well have called him Robert Louis Stevenson." And you look at the film The Dark Knight, and the baddie Harvey Dent, as he becomes Two-Face, is a graphic illustration of the same problem. Half of his face is burnt away. The 20th century, I think, has uniquely proved both the greatness and the wickedness of humanity. And in 1998, the Times newspaper in London invited readers to suggest, to send in words that summed up the 20th century as it drew to a close. So this was March 1998. And the top 10 words, is after they did all the analysis, were very revealing. These were some of the words that came up. 20th century, moon landings, television, the computer. And I think they definitely deserve to be there. They, you know, the 19th century would have seen each of those things as utterly inconceivable, or at least just science fiction. So they were remarkable things. But there are two other words in that top 10: Holocaust and genocide. Superheroes may well be fiction, and in their world, everything gets exaggerated, but this is the scary thing. They do not exaggerate when it comes to the human potential for both good and evil. Those are not an exaggeration, are they? I think the problem very often in Christian circles is we tend to focus on just one or the other. A more liberal perspective will just see the goodness in people. A more sort of perhaps fundamentalist aspect will just see the sin. Either way, you do not do justice to reality, to history, to life. We are both. And I think you see that in the superhero stories. Secondly, there are echoes of the great hero. The writer to Hebrews goes on in Hebrews 2, and he acknowledges that while that humanity does not currently occupy God's intended place for us, there is somebody who does. So he says, "We do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone." So he was above the angels, and he's superior to the angels, as Hebrews 1 proves. And then in Hebrews 2, he comes a little lower than the angels in order to do what we who are made a little lower than the angels were created to be and failed to be. So he becomes the perfect man because humanity failed to be what we were meant to be. It was the great, the second Secretary General of the Commonwealth, not the Commonwealth, the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was killed in mysterious circumstances in a plane crash. But he was a believer, and he said this, and I've never forgotten it, And I think it's absolutely brilliant. He said, I became a Christian in order to become a man. In order to be truly human. Because sin dehumanizes us. Jesus, in his incarnate form, he comes as a man, showing what humanity was meant to be. And Jesus is one with us, but he's also beyond us. He's fully human and he's fully divine. He's not 50-50, he's 100-100%. And in their different contradictory ways, you see, I think the superheroes are all grappling towards this sort of reality, aren't they? There are hundreds of examples. Sometimes they're quite overt. Now, this is a moment from the sort of Superman mythology. A baby is about to be sent from Earth to from Krypton to Earth, and his father, Jor-El, leaves a message for his son. He says this, "You will travel far, my little Kal-El, but we will never leave you. Even in the face of our deaths, you will make my strength your own. You will see my life through your eyes as your life will be seen through mine. The son becomes the father and the father the son." That could almost be straight out of John's gospel, couldn't it? It's a bit of a stretch, but not much. There is a Christian resonance there deliberately. Now, if you explore historic Christology, and that is the study of who Christ is and what he's done, then, if you study theology, you will study as a core subject Christology, the study of who Jesus is. And the classic definitions have two types of Christology. There's a Christology from below and a Christology from above. Christology from below starts with Jesus' humanity and works its way up towards his divinity. And a Christology from above starts with his divinity and follows him down to earth. The three Gospels in the New Testament that present Jesus of Nazareth from below are sometimes called the Synoptic Gospels. They see from one eye, with the same eye, Matthew, Mark and Luke. And they start with Jesus at our level. So when people first meet him, they might think he's pretty cool, but they don't think he's God. And one of Jesus' favourite titles for himself was Son of Man. Now, that's curious, because Son of Man is just a Hebrew phrase, just meaning guy, bloke, human being. So Ezekiel, do you remember in the famous dry bones bit? God tells Ezekiel, he says, Son of Man, prophesy. In other words, bloke, guy, man, prophesy. Okay, it doesn't mean anything other than just, or as C.S. Lewis might put it in Narnia, a daughter of Eve and a son of Adam. That's all it means. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a nightmare. It's not so much a vision as a horror. It's a nightmare. He wakes up in the middle of the night sweating in terror because he doesn't understand it. Why? Well, in Daniel 7, he sees a vision of the Ancient of Days, that is God, on his throne, bringing up one like a son of man, in other words, a bloke, bring him up to heaven and giving to this one man all power and authority on earth to judge. In other words, cosmic power is put into the hands of a human being. Is God mad? And Daniel doesn't get it. You wouldn't. And the worst thing about it is it almost seems like that this is now the Übermensch of Nietzsche. God is the one doing it, though. But then you come to Mark's Gospel, and you find that the Son of Man has authority, but what does he do with it? Well, do you remember that funny moment in Mark chapter 2 when there's a man on a stretcher lowered through the roof, and his friends bring him along, and what do they want? Well, they want him to be healed. That's why they brought him. All right? Can you imagine how humiliating it would have been for that man in the stretcher? It's enough to, you know, send you into counselling for 30 years after that, with all these people crowded round and just watching you. They're all looking at you, emphasising the fact that you're a cripple and you can't walk. Everybody's quiet. Complete hush. Jesus looks at him and says, "Your sins are forgiven." What? That's not what I came for. Now, the real shock of that story, when you look at it in Mark 2, the real shock is that when Jesus does do the healing, it's not for the guy's benefit on the mat. He does the healing for the Pharisees' benefit. Because he knows what they're thinking. They're saying, who can forgive sins but God alone? And of course that's right, because the person who is the victim of something is the only person who can forgive. And sin is against God. If you like, God is the victim of sin. So only God can forgive it. But what does Jesus do? He says, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, I'm going to say what it is easier to say to do, to prove I can do what it is harder to do. Get up and walk. The miracle is there designed to prove that he has the Son of Man's authority to forgive. So, Daniel's nightmare becomes the greatest fairy tale ever, except this fairy tale is true, because absolute power in the hands of one man is used to bring forgiveness and healing and hope. And the more people got to know Jesus, the more they realized there was more to this guy than meets the eye. So that the climax is they get to the point when they start worshipping him. Christology from below, from above, well, you see that more in, say, John's Gospel. Because the very first verse asserts his divinity. And then, the Word was with God and was God, became a man. In fact, the Word became flesh. And literally what goes on, he says it made his dwelling among us in the NIV translation, but literally the Greek means he tabernacled, he tented. It's a very odd word that John uses. He made his tent here. In other words, he is the tabernacle, he is the temple. Why? Because you go to the temple to meet God. So in chapter 2 of John's Gospel, he says you don't need a temple anymore. Destroy it. I'm going to destroy it and rebuild it in 3 days. And he's not talking about the temple, he's talking about his body. Why? Because you go to the temple to meet God. You go to Jesus to meet God. I and the Father are one, he said. And of course, one of the great names of Jesus in the New Testament is borrowed from Isaiah, Emmanuel, God with us. Isn't it interesting? The name for God in the Old Testament, in Hebrew, is El. El Shaddai. And so on and so forth, as we've all sung to Amy Grant. El. Now, I just wonder, could it not be that there's a little point being made about Jor-El and Kal-El? I don't know. Whatever we find in terms of these resonances, what is clearly true from the New Testament is the great superhero is not a figment of our human imagination. He's a figment of the divine imagination. It was God's idea. And Emmanuel means that in Jesus, God is living among us. He is God with us, God on our side, God for us. In other words, he's come from the outside into our broken world to rescue it. The world is searching for a hero. And of course, that's the point that the Superman Return films is making, because the reason Lois Lane wrote that article is because she was grieving. Because she says at that point, when, you know, after she sort of can no longer hold herself together, she says, how could you leave us like that? Well, why does the great superhero come? Well, you have echoes of the great rescue. Our world faces many challenges, as we've seen, as it has always been like that. Every generation has faced the same challenges. Wars and rumours of wars, it's going to be like that, and it has always been like that. We live in the last days. The last days began with Jesus' first coming and will end with his second coming. The last days, in biblical terms, is not just the last few weeks before his return. This is the last days. The last days have been going on for 2,000 years. They could go on for another 2,000 years or 2 weeks. Who knows, and who cares to one level. We're not to know the dates, but we live in the last days, and there are wars of rumors of wars. There's always been like that, and it always will. And the problem is, these fictitious superheroes are just that. Fictitious. They can't do anything. But the Bible says that God is real, Jesus Christ is real, his temperament and character is real, and the world's problems are real, and his rescue is real. We've lived in God's world as if it was our own. And if we're honest, we've not lived in a way that pleases or honors him. Not 24 hours a day, not 7 days a week, not if we're honest. So, what's God going to do? Well, if God wants to rescue his world, and we might question, why on earth would he want to? But if he does, he's going to do it. He can pull it off. And that's exactly what Isaiah said after having this vision of the baby born, Emmanuel, the baby who will be called the Mighty God, the Wonderful Counselor, the Prince of Peace, the Everlasting Father. And that passage in Isaiah 9 ends, and the zeal of the Lord will accomplish this. And he does it by sending his great hero, his son, to do something incredibly surprising. He comes to defeat our enemies, to defeat evil, to defeat our own sinfulness. That's surprising in itself that he would want to do that. But the way he does it is the most surprising way of all. Because this superhero dies. He gives himself up on the cross. And the most famous verse in the Bible sums it up perfectly. God so loved the world, that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. Without him, we will perish. But God doesn't want that. And that's why he sent the Lord Jesus. So there we have it. Are there any questions or thoughts or comments? Or have I gone completely mad? Am I completely over the top? Am I seeing things where they're just not there? Can you think of any more? That's a good question. Go on. The Doctor Who. Yes, superheroes from above. Doctor Who. Yes, can we think of any others? It's a good question. There are not that many. And I think that in itself is probably... I mean, I thought about this before because, you know, obviously wanted to sort of try and get as many sort of touch as many different ones as possible when I was illustrating it. And it is quite revealing that most of them are not. They're from below. And that in itself is part of our sort of sense that we can overcome somehow, I guess.
And the ones from above are, in a way, almighty.
Yes, the ones from above are almighty. And yet, isn't it interesting that I think I'm right in saying, I think it's fair to say that Superman probably is the most popular. And I don't think it's just because it's always some sort of beefy hunk in a silly costume. Because guys quite like watching Superman as well. It's not just girls. So that's right. But now, this is interesting. I did try and sort of find out about this. I heard from somebody that Schuster and Siegel are Jewish from New York, but they gradually crafted or shaped their sort of Superman mythology deliberately into a more Christian framework in order to make it work and be popular in America because of the sort of Christian subculture. And I can see that would be the case. And so, you know, I think there are some deliberate resonances with the sort of Christian myth, if you can put it like that, and that there's a sense in which that is partly a marketing strategy, but that in itself is quite interesting because you see Superman resonates across the world. It's not just an American phenomenon, and that's what I find interesting, that these films are incredibly popular in China, but then of course you see Chinese mythology has its great heroes as well. You know, sort of Crouching Tiger, Flashing Dragon, or whatever. What is that? I always get the adjectives muddled up. What is it? Crouching Tiger? Hidden, that's the one, yeah. Okay. Great. Well, thank you for coming.